Hi, everybody, and welcome to the second episode of the Rails Coach Podcast. I'm your host, Chuck Wood, and this week I'm going to be playing an interview that I did a month or so ago with Greg Pollock, who you probably know from the Rails Envy Podcast, the Ruby 5 Podcast, and several other things. Before we get started, I'd just like to remind you that if you want to leave feedback, you can do so by calling 801-753-8279 and leaving a message, or emailing podcast@railscoach.com. You can also email in audio files of your questions, and I'll play those or your voicemail messages on the show. Today's music is provided by Al Flip and the Woo Team. It's his Midnight composition, and it's available on musicalley.com. During the interview, Greg actually explains pretty well who he is, what his background is, and that kind of thing. So I'm just going to go ahead and play the interview, and I'll pick you up on the other side. Thanks. All right. So first off, I was just kind of curious to know how you got started with podcasting and with Rails Envy.
I've always been really into audio. I love audio as an art form just because I feel like it can be so much more immersive than both audio and video. It's like when you have audio and video, things have to be so much more together. Things have to be so much more in sync. You can't have, if you have crappy audio, even if it's like good video, it's not any good, right? But whereas you can have crappy video and good audio, and you can still watch stuff, think like Blair Witch. So I love creating audio. I like listen to a lot of podcasts. I listen to some of my favorites are like Radiolab, This American Life. I listen to a lot of audio books, so I'm a big audio guy. And to get into the podcasting stuff, that's just something that Jason and I always listen to podcasts together and the same stuff, and we talk about things afterwards, whether it was Radiolab or any of the other podcasts. And at some point we realized there was really no good podcast for Ruby and Rails people to talk about news. So we said, let's give that a try. So we threw something together. And of course, this is after we've done some video together that, some of the viral videos. And so it was cool. And Rails Envy did pretty well there for a while. It was good.
So what made you change your mind or switch over to do Ruby 5?
What happened was a few months ago now, I run the Orlando Ruby Users Group. And, I've been doing that for about 2 years now. And when you do something like that, it starts to become more and more obvious, like, who the good developers are in town. Inevitably, you figure out who are the guys that are coming every month that really know their stuff, that are passionate about programming. And so I kind of got to a point a couple months ago where I was like, okay, I know who the smart people are. I want to try to maybe bring them together, see if I can get an office together, bring in some of the smartest people I know, and see what happens, whether we start doing client work, start doing internal projects. And I can talk a little bit if you want more about the philosophy of that, but I don't want to get too far off track. So I brought a bunch of people together and started building a business. And at that point, Jason wasn't really in a good place to join. He didn't really want to be a part of that business. So I created Envy Labs, which is a separate company. And we decided to make Rails Envy just a blog. It started as a blog, and then we ran it as a company for a while. And now it's back as a blog and a podcast. And so because I was moving over to this new company, I kind of made more sense to sort of put everything under this new company. And I kind of had a different, Jason and I had a different of opinions, how to do the Ruby 5, how to do the Rails Envy podcast. Whereas we always had a conflict where I want to be more newsy and he want to be more talky. And so I figured, maybe I should create a podcast under Envy Labs. And that's what Ruby 5 became. And I think it's awesome now. I really think it's awesome that the Ruby community now has two really good podcasts. And they're two different styles. If you're the kind of person that likes listening to talk radio and, having two personalities go at it, like Jason and Dan are awesome at that. I was just listening to them this morning. And if you want something that's more sort of like NPR News meets Ruby News, that's where Ruby 5 comes in. A short format that's not going to take up too much of your day, that cuts right to the chase and, gives you a slice of Ruby News twice a week. So I think it's awesome that we got two podcasts now. I was just thinking this morning, maybe it'd be cool to do a blog post somewhere on all the different good podcasts and screencasts that are out there in the Ruby world, because we've got lots of good ones. And that was a really long-winded answer.
It was, but it was good. And it's interesting because I still listen to Rails Envy, and I've been listening to Ruby 5. And as you know, my opinion is that Ruby 5 should be a little longer, maybe a little more talky, and Rails Envy could be a little shorter and a little less talky. So
there you go. You know, perfect then, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely a good balance, and everyone has a different opinion. You know, when we were doing the longer episodes, some people that I talked to at conferences would say it'd be better as a shorter format, you know, and some people like the longer format. Some people wish it would go on longer. But when you've got sort of the focused, you know, content that we do, we're really scripted with Ruby 5, whereas with Rails Envy, they're not as scripted as you can hear sort of that they're sort of goofing off and talking, and they're good at that. They're good at doing the talk radio stuff, which I could never do. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty crappy at sort of the improv that both Dan and Jason are really good at.
Yeah, that makes sense. Envy Labs, I'm trying to focus this podcast on ways that people can become better developers or better Rails or Ruby developers. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that you were kind of looking for the best developers in your area and, you know, what you were doing to find them and start your company. I was just wondering, what qualities do you look for in the people that you bring into Envy Labs?
Well, I'm looking for people that, you know, I've seen at the Ruby Users Group meetings, you know, that have contributed, maybe people that have spoken there, so we know that they know their stuff. Maybe they've come to some of the Hackfests that we've done. That's actually how I met Jason in the first place. I had a Ruby Group Hackfest, and I paired with him, and I was like, wow, here's a guy who's like just at my level. He's got awesome sort of code skills. I was like, there's no reason why I shouldn't hire him. I looked for people who kind of that I know are good because either I've seen them code or they've presented at Ruby users groups. But where I thought you might head with that question, and it's sort of an interesting topic, is, you know, how do you make those programmers? How do you get programmers to that point? And what role do the Ruby users groups play? And one of the big things that sort of come up recently with the different conferences I've been to, it's become more clear to me that programming as a profession, people don't practice enough, you know. And when you think about like playing a musical instrument, you know, in an orchestra, those people, they go home and they practice. They have to practice. If they didn't practice, somebody else would take their place. But yet with our, you know, with programming, you know, people don't do that. You know, you typically don't, a lot of people don't, you know, sit down and do a piece of code just for practice or do a code kata. So one of the things over the next few months that I'm going to try to bring into the Ruby users groups, and I've got a couple ideas on how to do it, is make people practice more. So instead of having a presentation 1 week, we might do some code katas 1 week and do some pair programming. And I think that that's going to produce more expert programmers in Orlando, you know, than if we were doing presentations every month, you know?
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. How would you suggest that people select their code kata or their practice? Does it matter what they pick to do, or should they be focusing in specific areas?
Well, I think it's important to focus on, you know, I wouldn't, you know, build a Rails app. You know, I think it's more important that Rails developers out there focus more on building their, you know, basic, you know, Ruby skills and, you know, probably Ruby metaprogramming skills. And to find the right code katas out there, I mean, there's a couple resources out there. I know that the first place I'd go is Dave Thomas. Actually wrote a couple of blog articles a while back on code katas. And so I think you could probably just search for Code Kata Dave Thomas, you'd probably find them. And that's one place to go. You could also go to Ruby Quiz, right? Ruby Quiz has been, you know, they've got like tons and tons of resources and challenges that you could do. So I'd just go maybe find one, bring that into your users group, split up into pairs and try to solve them. And then, of course, at the end of the night, you have to be able to, you know, have each team come up and show how they solve the problem. Even if it's a problem that you couldn't solve in 30 minutes, it's still really interesting to see how far people got.
That's true. That's very true. We, I go to the Utah Ruby Users Group.
Awesome.
And we did an exercise where we were building a chat server, and basically it was just an exercise with threads, and it was really interesting just to see how people approach that and how they interacted with what they had, and you know, how they used the threads to pass messages back and forth and things like that. And so I definitely see the value there.
Cool.
What would you recommend for people who aren't in an area that has a users group that they can attend?
Start one. but yeah, I mean, like the Ruby users group started out with like four guys in a room. I brought pizza, you know. You're always going to start out small. If you're in a city right now that doesn't have a users group, that's an amazing opportunity to start doing it, you know, establish yourself as the Ruby guy in the city. I mean, that's what's going to happen if you start the Ruby users group. A year later, when hopefully you started to get more people, you know, people are going to come to you with Ruby work. It's going to be a great thing for your business. Now, mind you, it's not just enough to just start a group. You obviously have to do some sort of advertising. And aside from, you know, spamming the, you know, the online mailing lists, which you definitely should do, like, you know, the Ruby discussion group, because inevitably there'll be people in your area that are listening, it's also important to go around to all of the other users groups in your area and talk about your group. So one way that I sort of brought a lot of people to the users group is the first Ruby users group was a, well, not really the first one, the couple in, was a introduction to Ruby and Rails, right? And so I had that meeting planned about 2 months in advance, and I went around to every single user group that I could find in Orlando, because there's other ones. There's, you know, .NET and Java and PHP. And I went around to those guys and said, hey, you know, I'm doing an introduction to Ruby and Rails. If you want to expand your brain a little bit, come see what it's about, right? So that's a really good way to sort of bring people into your users group. And also something we mentioned on the podcast a few weeks or a week or two back, the Rails Bridge project has a bunch of material that you can use for free to do a Ruby and Rails tutorial. And so if you want to bring more people in your city into Ruby and Rails, I mean, that's the way to do it. You know, go and, you know, find a venue for free, find a local community college that, you know, you can say, you know, hey, I want to run this really inexpensive tutorial, and it's just going to be a day long on a Saturday, because you're probably not using the classrooms anyway on Saturday. And then go out and advertise and run your tutorial. You've got all the information you need up on that website, to all the slides, all the code. So you have no excuse not to start, you know, the small seed of Ruby in your community.
That makes sense. On to another topic. if you Google Greg Pollack, one of the things that comes up is the Rails activists.
Oh, cool, yeah.
You want to tell us a little bit about that, what the Rails activists are around for?
Yeah, that's a good question. Basically, if you look around at a lot of the, if you're not familiar with what sort of activist group are, a lot of the, there's a bunch of open source projects out there. When they get big to a point, they start, you know, they're needing, you know, if they're smart enough, they find people who are, you know, public faces that can sort of do some of the publicity and education, and sometimes even sort of be the buffer between the public and the core team. All right. So that's sort of why the Rails activists were created. And some of the guys on there, like Ryan Bates, it's like he's already kind of an activist before he was an activist, just because of the Rails cast. So each of us on there are people that, you know, are putting out a lot of publicity, whether it's podcasts, educational material. You know, it's really important, you know, going around and speaking at conferences. It's really important to us to spread the word of Ruby and Rails and highlight good work that's going on in the community. And yeah, so that's what we do. And coming up with Rails 3, we've got some interesting ideas about, you know, trying to push Rails, you know, back into some, you know, get it some really good publicity with Rails 3, because it's definitely an opportunity to take advantage of that. So right now we're sort of working on that, figuring out how we can sort of launch Rails 3 and maybe, you know, maybe create some viral videos, do something fun with it. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, we're trying to figure out right now how to, material that we can create or publicity that we can put out that will attract some developers from other languages back into Rails.
Okay. About Rails 3, I've actually pulled down the source code, and I've been playing with it a little bit. And you've told me a couple of times when I've emailed you different places where I can go to get information about Rails 3. Do you want to share any of those with us on this podcast?
Well, yeah. I mean, aside from doing as you did and pulling down the source code, I know that Yehuda has started some work on the wiki to sort of document the different pieces of the puzzle. I know that there's a couple really good conference talks I can know offhand. But Yehuda's been sort of all over the world in the past, like, 3 months talking about Rails 3. And some of his most recent presentations give a really good overview of everything that's going on with Rails 3. One that I'm really looking forward to being up, he was talking at Aloha on Rails, was one of these conferences. And hopefully his talk will come up soon, because he gave a really good overview of Rails 3. That'd probably be your best bet if you wanted to get a big picture of what's going on in the source.
Okay. Yeah, I heard him speak in March at the Mountain West RubyConf, and I also went to a couple of his talks at RailsConf, so he's definitely a good presenter, and I think it'd be a great place for people to look.
Yeah, over the past few months, things have definitely evolved in Rails 3. So that, you know, some of his more recent presentations, things are definitely more fleshed out and solidified, which is awesome. So I'm really excited for Rails 3. There's a lot of, you know, there's so many broad-ranging changes at all the different levels of the stack that it's going to be really interesting to see what sort of innovation, you know, I'm more interested in what happens after it gets released, you know, because what I love doing with the podcast and stuff is finding people who do good work and sort of, you know, bringing them to the, you know, giving them publicity like on Ruby 5, or if they're really good, you know, putting them up on the official weblog. And I think that Rails 3 is going to open up a whole other line of innovation, just because, you know, for a couple different reasons, one of them being because everything is so pluggable now. Components aren't dependent on other components, so that if you wanted to, you know, create your own active support library, you could, and I'm sure people will. And I think that's what gets that's where it gets really exciting, because you can take Rails and you can totally customize it to do exactly what you need it to do, or build a new functionality that and, you know, change it into something that makes it almost unrecognizable using the core framework.
Yeah, that is something that I'm looking forward to, and I have plans for different things that I want to try and see if I can get it to hook into the core framework just to see what it's capable of.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just a matter of having the time and having the resources to do it. We mentioned RailsConf. At RailsConf, you put up the Ruby Heroes.
Yeah.
What was the selection process behind that, and what kind of contributions would you like to see in the Ruby and Rails community over the next year?
Basically, for each of the Ruby Heroes, we've done Ruby Hero Awards. This last year was the second year we did it. And each year, you know, we put out a website where people can go onto it and nominate people. And if you've tried it, you'll notice that, you know, when you nominate somebody, you also have to, you know, type something about them, like why you think they're awesome. You know, and so the first year we took that list and we sort of brought together a team of people in the Ruby community that people respected, and so we looked at what the community brought to us, and then that internal team figured it out. The second year, the team that helped pick were actually the heroes from the previous year. It's kind of neat, kind of makes sense. So the second year, we had people nominate, and then I went to all the heroes from the previous year and said, okay, who deserves it this year? And one thing that's definitely interesting about the awards that I want to make sure people know is that it's for people who don't get as much credit as they deserve, right? Because there's definitely some people in the community that do good stuff, but people already know who they are. You know, they already know they have a popular blog, they get a lot of traffic, or, you know, they have a lot of credibility already. But the Hero Awards are really to recognize people that maybe don't get as much credit as they deserve. And, you know, I think we've done a pretty good job identifying those people and sort of, you know, giving them sort of awards for doing really good work in the community.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, I thought it was really interesting just to see, you know, the breadth of things that people were being recognized for and how they were getting involved. And, you know, it's kind of prodded me in a couple of different directions as far as different projects that I'm working on.
Nice.
I have another question for you regarding the Scaling Rails screencasts that you did. Those have been extremely helpful for us here at PMA Media Group. I was wondering, you know, what prompted those and maybe other areas that people can explore related to that.
Okay, so the Scaling Rails screencast. Yeah, so I started getting into the screencast stuff with EnvyCast. So I put out a bunch of paid screencasts. And then I was in a conference in San Francisco talking to Mike Malloy from New Relic. And Mike's been an avid supporter of the podcast. He was sponsoring the podcast a bunch with New Relic. And he kind of came to me and said, hey, what can we do? You know, New Relic wants to invest, you know, a little more money in developing the Rails community. I love that. I love that, you know, some companies, you know, when venture capital helps, when they have, you know, a little extra money, these big companies see the value in not only, you know, sponsoring the community and sponsoring things in the community, but figuring out, things they can invest in that will improve the community itself, that will build new Ruby and Rails developers, that will build new successful Rails websites. And so they came to me with that, and I was probably on the edge of doing a Scaling Rails screencast at that point, because I did a Scaling Ruby screencast, and obviously the next thing would be a Scaling Rails screencast. And I talked to them, and I said, well, hey, if you want to sponsor this screencast, we can just release it for free. And they liked that idea. And then we came up with the idea of maybe instead of doing, you know, like 1-hour-long video, maybe what we do is we split that up into, you know, episodes and release those 1 week apart so that people, you know, subscribe and come back week after week. And then they came up with the idea of Rails Lab. So, you know, I produced a bunch, like, I think at first I produced like 9 or 10 or 12 of them. And then since then, every couple months, they've been nice enough to say, hey, you know, we'll produce a couple more. So I actually have got 3 of them that I'm waiting for them to release. And you've got the scoop, but I've got 3 more videos queued up in Rails Lab that I'm waiting for them to release so that there can be even more information out there on scaling Rails. And I love that there's that resource now when people say, you know, can Rails scale? What's the deal? You know, this is what I hear. And I can say, okay, well, look, there's these screencasts, you know, on this webpage that tell you everything you need to know. But really, the stuff up on here is stuff you're only going to need to know, like, 0.0%, you know, like 0.01% of the time. And, you know, because scaling is something that we all wish we had a problem with scaling, right? Because most websites don't need it.
That's true. We didn't exactly have a problem with scaling, but what we found is that a lot of the things that you talk about in there helped us address some of the speed issues that we had with our pages.
Nice.
And so we set up some of the caching and found that Memcache and some of the other resources that you recommend in the screencast are more responsive than hitting the database, pulling the data out, and serving it up.
Awesome.
And so, you know, I would also, you know, recommend them to anyone else who's hitting some of those same issues.
Very cool. Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah. So one other question I have for you is are there any gems or plugins or things that people could write for Ruby or Rails that you think the community is missing or you know, could enhance people's experience with Ruby?
That's
prompt a little.
What's that?
Prompt a little community involvement here.
Stuff that the community should create. Well, if you're looking for an opportunity out there that, you know, something that somebody's not built yet, I think the easiest way is to start taking a look at some of, like, the .com startups, you know, the kind of websites you see on Mashable, the kind of websites that, you know, are about to release their new API, right? And that's the one thing that I sort of love about the Rails community and the Ruby community is that I find this new website, they've got an API, I want to use it. What's the first thing I do? I go onto GitHub, I search for gems. Somebody's probably already created a gem for that API. So if you want to sort of, you know, create something that people use that nobody's created yet, you know, a good way to do that is simply to, you know, keep an eye out for new websites that have APIs that need Ruby gems written for them. So maybe that would be one thing you could do, you could add and you can create. And then, of course, and so, but it's not enough just to write a gem. You write the gem, you put it on GitHub, you you know, push it to you know, use GemCutter and push it to the new gems website, and then you email then you write a blog post that has a tutorial about how to use the gem, and then you email me at what's the news email, ruby5@nvlabs.com, and then you get the gem on the podcast, and then you submit it to Ruby Flow, and you know, and email a few people about it, you know, do a little self publicity so that people use it, and then people go, oh hey, you know, check that out, you know, this guy created this gem, and I'm gonna use it.
Yeah, and it's funny because if you build it, people use it. And the other funny thing is to me is that I mean, you know, I have my blog out there that I've been working on for the last 4 or 5 months, and it's amazing how much traffic I've gotten just from emailing you and getting it featured on Rails Envy or on Ruby 5, you know, and just what a difference it makes. And it's interesting to me, too, that, you know, I'm this kid from Utah that has been programming Ruby and Rails professionally for about a year and a half. And yet what I put out there, other people are using and finding useful.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I really think that it's important for people to take the opportunity to get involved. And if it's if you're not comfortable speaking or writing or blogging, you know, you can contribute with your code. And I think it's important that people find ways to get involved.
Yeah, I think that's one of the awesome things about the Ruby community is how much, you know, open source software people put out there. And, you know, there's a lot to be said for putting out quality open source software. Like, we were just looking for, you know, to hire some people here, you know, in the office, some local people. And, you know, so I sent out an email to the users group, said, hey, we're looking for some work. A couple people replied. And, you know, we asked for some code, you know, send us some of your code. And, you know, one of the guys sent us, you know, some of the stuff he's been working on, and it was amazingly clean, you know, some of the open source software. So if you put some open source software out there and people can look at your code samples, as hopefully most companies will do if they try to hire you as a programmer, you know, if you have some good stuff out there, well, it's probably better than, you know, having a degree.
Really? Well, that makes me feel good. I worked 6 years to get my 4-year degree. One last question before I let you go, and this goes back to what you were saying about developers practicing what they do.
Mm-hmm.
What is the difference between practice and performance, so to speak, between what I do at work and what I do when I'm, you know, just doing a code kata or noodling around with a new library or something?
What is the difference?
Yeah, you know, you were talking about how, you know, we work professionally,
mm-hmm.
as coders, and then you basically pointed out that, you know, as professional coders, we don't practice what we do enough.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So what's the difference between what I'm doing at work and what I should be doing when I practice?
Go ahead.
Yeah, so basically the question is why isn't what I do at work practice enough for programming?
Well, would you want a doctor to practice during your operation? All right, that's one way to kind of think of it. Hopefully they're not practicing while they work on you. And it's sort of the same thing. It's like, is it good enough quality for our clients if we're, you know, practicing and trying things out on their dime? It's like, I don't know if we should be trying things out on their dime. I mean, obviously, you can do some refactoring, you know, if you're, you know, testing stuff. But I'm not sure. You know, I think that really to focus your programming skills, you need to go outside of that. You need to be able to write a piece of code that you know maybe you're just going to throw away afterwards. You know, another good way to sort of, you know, hone your skills as a programmer is to do pair programming. I know it's kind of hard to afford to do that, but more companies are figuring it out. A lot of the big Ruby and Rails companies are all doing pair programming now, and it's amazing how much you learn doing pair programming. We're not doing enough of it around here, and I've realized, like, you know, we've worked in this office for like 4 or 5 months now. Nate, who's sitting across the table from me over here, is an amazing programmer. He's a better programmer than I am, and I'm not absorbing any of his knowledge because we're not coding together and we're not practicing together. And, you know, I'm realizing that that's sort of, you know, I'm not taking advantage of that. I'm not improving my skills, but I kind of have that opportunity. So I need to put myself in a position where, you know, somehow maybe we're looking over his code together, we pair some of the time, or we work on code katas together, because I definitely want to absorb some of that knowledge. And, you know, in some of the ways you can do that at companies, you know, besides pair programming, you know, doing katas in your spare time, one company I was at, every Wednesday, they ate lunch in. So everyone would go out, get some lunch, come back to the conference room, and one person would just sort of show off some of their code. You know, here's something new that I've been working on. You know, here's, you know, a challenge that I had. Here's how I solved it. And just sort of walk through their code and figure out their, you know, how they solved the problem that they had in front of them. That's definitely another way to do it, just to have a group code review.
So do you recommend that people take the time or be given the time to do this kind of stuff at work? Or, you know, is this something that people should be doing on their own time?
I'd say both. I mean, it depends, you know, how much your company values education and, you know, improving the programmers' skills. You know, hopefully you're working for a company that gives you time to, you know, go back and refactor code that you may not be entirely happy with. Hopefully you're working for a company that maybe allows you to pair some of the time or that encourages, you know, peer code review. You know, so I guess part of that responsibility, you know, if you're working for an employer that loves its employees, you know, part of the responsibility is for the employer if they want to improve the skills of their employees. But then also, if you want, you know, if you're an independent contractor, obviously, you know, it's up to you to put yourself in positions where you're focusing on improving your code and practicing and trying out new things and writing new libraries. And reading other people's code. You know, I think that, you know, if you're listening to this right now and you want to improve your code by reading other people's code, which is also really important, go read Rails 3. You know, there's a lot of new code in there. Go take a look at the history, at the commits, and, you know, see what people are doing in there and what their code looks like. You might learn something.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Greg. I've really learned a lot from the interview, and I think a lot of people are going to benefit from it.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah. We'll hopefully see you at other events, other conferences, things like that.
Yeah, definitely.
All right.
Cool.
Bye.
Bye.
So that was the interview with Greg Pollock. It was chock full of great stuff, and I recommend that you go to the show notes where I've put links up to most of the stuff that we talked about. This was kind of a long podcast, so I'm just going to end it here. But thank you for listening, and next week we'll go ahead and talk a little bit about finding a good mentor and just where you can find them, what you can do to encourage people to teach you, and just things related to that. So thank you very much, and have a great day.